1 Samuel 16. Now the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons." But Samuel said, "How can I go when Saul hears of it? He will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me the one whom I designate to you." So Samuel did what the Lord said and came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, "Do you come in peace?" And he said, "In peace I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourself and come with me to the sacrifice." He also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Then it came about when they entered that he looked at Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel, and he says, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Next Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." And thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are these all your children?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep." Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and bring him, for he will not sit down until he comes here." So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." And then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel arose and went to Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. And Saul's servant then said to him, "Behold, now an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. Let our Lord now command your servant who are before you. Let them seek a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall come about, when the evil spirit from God is on you, that he shall play the harp with his hand, and you will be well." And so Saul said to his servants, "Provide for me now a man who can play well, and bring him to me." Then one of the young men answered and said, "Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him." And so Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the flock." And Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and a jug of wine and a young goat and sent them to Saul by David his son. Then David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly. And he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." So it came about, whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit will depart from him.
Thank you, Hector. That was 1 Samuel chapter 16. Before I get into my little spiel here, are there any comments or questions or things that didn't quite make sense to you? Hold on a second. We'll get... Go ahead, Sammy.
There are a couple of points that that caught me as you were reading that. Number one, David is the eighth son of Jesse.
Correct. Not, yeah.
That, to me, is kind of interesting. I'd always thought he was the seventh, but then when hearing him read that, was the eighth. So that is an interesting number. And the other thing is that when David comes into Saul's household, it was initially just to be his musician, which is basically a court jester, entertainer,
right.
What is that? But he quickly becomes Saul's armor bearer. And when you were reading in earlier chapters about Jonathan and his armor bearer, gives you an idea of how important that position actually is.
Yes. It is a very important position. We're going to talk about that today, hopefully. It's as those of you who recall the previous few chapters we've gone through, Jonathan and his armor bearer, they started a war, essentially, with the Philistines. In the last battle, the major battle they went through, Jonathan's armor bearer went up and took out a raiding party, the two of them. Jonathan took up the front, the armor bearer was behind him, killing guys in the back. So armor bearer has a very important role. They are not just, as a kid, I always thought, armor bearers, they carried the armor, right? That's all they really did. No, they're also a sparring partner. They help the person learn how to improve their technique of killing and doing battle. So guess who the armor bearer has to be able to do? It also has to be able to kill equally as well or near as well as the person they're training. They are sparring partners. That's what you do to one another. So being an armor bearer is actually a very key role for David. And it obviously shows up in his skill level as he learns to and gets the opportunity to use it in later years. Any other comments or questions? Oh, by the way, the eighth son, I'm hoping to get to that too. It is interesting that God would choose anew again, so to speak, which we'll get to number eight. Those who don't recall what it means, we'll get to there when we get that point. Any other comments, questions?
Read and hear that God would be the one sending the distressing spirit upon Saul.
Right.
But after reading the Old Testament over and over, God is able to do anything he wishes, even speak through a donkey.
Very true. We usually try to imagine God as being all wonderful and loving of all people. And yes, he is wonderful and loving of people, but individuals are, and I liken them to tools. They're nothing more than an object that can be used at a given moment in time for God's purpose. And if he chooses to do something with that object, in this case, it happens to be put a spirit of ill content to another individual, that's his business. He's a talented individual. God, he can do whatever he wishes. So I don't, as a child, I used to view God as being, this wonderful, loving father. And yes, he is, but loving fathers also have a spanking hand. That's the nature of them. Kathy, you had a question quick?
I was under the same teaching, about God never doing anything that would cause any harm at all. But there are consequences. And in the realm I came from, it was like, when that happened, it was the enemy, and everybody always blames God. Well, when I spanked my children, the enemy didn't come in and do it for me. It was my hand.
Very true. Very true. Any other comments or questions? Oh, hold on a second.
I just want to add to that we give so much glory to devil that doesn't belong to him.
Very true.
We don't give enough praise and glory to God who is almighty.
That's true. We're giving the punishment aspect of God to another entity like the devil or whatever. It does take the tract from him because he is the one who is dictating what does and doesn't happen. And that includes punishments. It takes a tool of his or an aspect of him and pretends it doesn't exist. That's not true. God is of all things. If he created people and we have all those characteristics within inside of us, he has all those same characteristics inside of him. He has the ability to cause harm, much like we have the ability to cause harm. If he's like us, as is claimed that he is, then we're going to be very, very similar in our reasoning, thought process, and how we deal with things. Granted, he's much superior in that fashion, but he still has those emotions, still has those capabilities inside of him. In the comments or questions? Okay, we'll go a little spiel here. This is an interesting chapter. As I mentioned a few months ago, we got to meet David the first time. It says, of course, as the description was, a ruddy individual but good looking. What does that mean? Well, we'll get there. We use the word ruddy anymore, but say it again. Oh. Good eyesight. Well, this is eyes. Obviously, good-looking individual, or relatively good-looking in comparison to possibly than the average. It's hard to say. But Ruddy, he has, well, I use the word, a child youth-like flair to him. That's how I've always viewed him. Not like an infant child, not like a little child, but a youthfulness to him. A youthfulness that has a little ruggedness to go along with it, but you'll learn more about David's character as the next couple of chapters come along. His early character, not as an older man. Very into battles, very into killing. He thinks it's interesting. He's very drawn to it, which is the reason why God called him such a bloody man. He was bloody. It was not something that he was afraid of. He had, it records in a few chapters from now, he kills a lion. He also kills a bear with his hands. I mean, this is not a child. I would not expect my 2-year-old son to do this. I would not expect me at the age of 20 to do that. You wouldn't catch me, actually, probably you would catch me dead near them, because that's the closest I would ever get. the chances of me surviving something would not be realistic. But in David's case, it's not. He's a fairly large individual to be able to take out a bear and a lion. Now, granted, not at the same time. They're probably two independent circumstances. I doubt they both occurred simultaneously. But he's a very aggressive individual. So we just meet David. But we'll get a little bit more about him as his character develops. First of all, first one. This is the beautiful contrast between God chooses when he chose Saul versus when he chooses David. First one, it points out, it says that God talks to Samuel, "How will you mourn over Saul? I've rejected him from Israel. Fill your horn with oil and go forth. I'll send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have seen a king for myself among his sons." Fill your horn with oil. Anybody recall that statement? We talked this a few chapters ago when Saul was anointed. What did Samuel do when Saul was anointed? Did he fill his horn with oil to anoint Saul? No. No. Oh, okay, so what? Well, what did Samuel use when he anointed Saul? It was a little earthen vial or glass jar. Nothing terribly impressive. It's an innocuous point. So what? What does that mean? Well, it means something because we know what the word horn means, especially when God's the one who's using that name. It's not just a little object. Who cares, some vessel? No. God never uses the term horn as just some innocuous object. Every time he uses the word horn, it's always the power, the entity, the one which is in control, the owner, the one, the kingdom. The mountain, everything that there ever was, is in that horn. Horn is used in that form. When you go through the book of Daniel, it discusses the four horns and with the ram and the goats and whatever, all divided up, the various horns. They are individual branches of the same government that breaks apart into individual powers. That's what horns are used for. Right? That was a vision given to Daniel from God. God used that word horn. He used that terminology, what it was used for. So then God tells him, go ahead and take his horn and bring it over to David. It means something. And what does it mean? Well, God told you what it means in that same verse. But he says, "How long will you mourn? Blah, blah, blah. Then I shall send to you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have seen a king for myself among his sons." A king for God's self? Those of you who recall, when God chose Saul, he said, "I have seen a king for the people, not a king for myself." Actually, God never used the word king when he described Saul. He used the word ruler. And we already discussed this many times over. The word ruler is not king. Ruler, Samuel, outranks a ruler. Samuel's a judge. Saul was essentially the aspect of Samuel, the judges, if you recall correctly. It is not only just physical warfare the responsibility is, but it's also spiritual judging. Well, Samuel took the warfare aspect and gave it to Saul. God, sorry, took the warfare aspect and gave it to Saul. Samuel kept his spiritual rules that he must obey and he must judge. Saul answered to Samuel. Samuel told Saul what to do. Samuel told Saul where to go. Samuel told Saul when he did something wrong. And what did Saul have to do? I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I have made an error. That's what a father would do to a child. Yes, child, you have made an error. Yes, child, you have done wrong. That's Samuel outranks Saul. And even in Saul's own account, he treats Samuel as much greater than himself. David, on the other hand, is not the case. Yeah, David didn't do spiritual judging. That wasn't his task. He was much similar in the fact that he had to go out to battles and warfare. We'll read that as we go through the various chapters. But God chose David as God's king. As he says, so a king for myself. Those of you who don't recall, it was 1 Samuel 8:23 when it says, crown a king for them. Referring when he describes Saul. God tells Samuel, crown a king for them. This is a king for myself. And Samuel didn't use a horn filled with oil. He used an earthen vessel, which is very commonly used. But in this case, God commanded him, no, use your horn. Because I'm going to give him a kingship. I'm giving him my kingdom. Very important individual that God has chosen. And then Samuel responds. Samuel's response, I can't go. Saul will kill me when he finds out. God, I can't do this. Now, why do we not see God saying, have you no faith, Samuel? Come on, I've told you, do you not believe me? Like he does to various other prophets. Because it's true. Saul would kill him. But what was God's response? Did he say, oh, don't worry? No. God didn't say, don't worry. God said, this is what you're going to do. I'm going to create a cover story for you. Bring a cow, heifer in this case, with you and say you're going to sacrifice if you're caught by any of Saul's men. Well, why didn't God just say, well, don't worry about it, Samuel. I'll take care of it. Saul won't bug you. I command you to go forth. Go forth. He could have done that. But he didn't. Well, why not? Because God knows the Torah so much better than we do. Saul, as king, has the Torah-given right to kill or execute rebels. God gave kings that right. So when Samuel's saying, wait a minute, God, I can't go, he'll kill me if he finds out, Samuel's right. He will kill him, and Saul would be justified in killing him. Because he's going to anoint another king. Completely, legitimately following the Torah. That's the law. Samuel knew the law. God clearly knew the law. So Samuel had to say, hey God, I can't do this. Because Saul will be justified in killing me. Thus, David will not get anointed by at least Samuel. God said, no, that's okay. Yes, technically that's true. I'll give you a cover story. A way around the problem, so that Saul doesn't find out. Thus, he doesn't kill you. I'm going to go through this a little quickly, because I want to get to my little chart I have drawn up here. It's a perspective chart, if I use that term. Timelines are a little bit illegitimate, because no one actually knows when all this stuff occurs. They know the approximate ages, but there's no guarantee. A perspective is, they know around when it occurs. So I use that terminology instead. So it's not much of a timeline, but we'll get there in a minute. Because it's important to know what or when all this stuff occurs. Because these people, to me, I've always read, for example, the book of Judges. There are various chapters in there. And okay, that part of life ends. Let's go to the next book. All new characters. Start all over again. And we ignore that, well, wait a minute. The characters are in the next book. A good chunk of them were alive in the previous book. They're the same people, or at least their immediate children. These people know each other. Things occur, they occur together. These aren't isolated incidents like we break them up into little chapters. These are overwhelming things that occur. So I have a little perspective chart there, which we'll get through, hopefully. Let's see, I'll jump through. Okay, verse 4. Samuel goes to Bethlehem. travels with him with Heifer. Now, the elders' response about him. Now, this maybe seem unimportant to you, but it actually does mean something. He goes, the elders of the city hurried nervously toward him, or apprehensively. And one of them said, "Do you come in peace?" And he answered, "Peace. To bring an offering to the Lord, I have come." So prepare for yourselves, join me at the feast. He invited Jesse and his sons, calling them to the feast. Why were the elders nervous? Yeah, why were they nervous? Why were they apprehensive? Yes, Tammy.
Well, he is a judge.
He is a judge.
And when the judge comes to town, you kind of wonder, did somebody do something wrong?
Uh-huh. Did God command him to come arrive? Because he wasn't summoned. What was he bringing with him? It was a female heifer. It was a heifer, a cow. Well, that can be taken a couple different ways. Well, if you're bringing a cow in general, what does it sometimes, always, but sometimes mean? A leader did something wrong. If I'm a leader and he came to my town and said, you brought a cow with you. what'd I do? Are you coming in peace? Am I in trouble? Now, a female cow is also allowed, according to the book of Leviticus, for a peace offering, a celebration offering. Female or male doesn't make a difference. So it's not that it had to be one, but as a leadership, I'd be a little concerned. I'd be a little, I don't know what's going on there. But what else, and probably the most important thing would be on my mind at this moment in time where I see Samuel coming with this cow? Well, who amongst Israel at this point did not know that Samuel reprimanded Saul and said the crown will be torn away from you? Because it was very public that Samuel did this. So who didn't know that? David? Possibly not David. But I'm willing to bet he actually did know. I'm willing to bet everybody knew. Everybody knew that Samuel told Saul, God has removed this crown or this kingdom from you. And he will give it to another, as he clearly stated very publicly in the previous chapter. Everybody was aware of it. So if I'm a leader of a new town, and I see Samuel coming here with this cow, what's the one thing that I don't want to see happen? I don't want to be anointed as the king, because Saul will kill me. And legally, he can. As a king, as an elder, there are things which you don't want to see happen. And one of the things is you don't want to see your neck on the line. Yeah, they're nervous. Yeah, they're a little concerned. Yeah, they know that Samuel's out. He has to choose another king, whoever it was going to be. No one knew. They have reason to be nervous. Yes, Tammy.
And you also don't want your town to be known as a hotbed of insurrection and treason.
Very true. That doesn't go over so well either. I believe Saul wiped out a few cities for doing things like that. At least one of them. So they all knew about Saul's rejection. Most likely these elders are not exactly pleased to see Samuel coming to them. Because note, even Samuel said, Saul will kill me if he sees me traveling to anoint someone. They all know what he has to go do. So they all know Samuel, wherever he comes, Saul's men are probably tracking him, watching him, seeing what he's going to do. Because he can kill him. If he does anything wrong. Meaning, wrong as far as Saul's concerned, Saul's eyes. The elders were justified in being a bit nervous. Of course, Jesse goes to all of his sons, Eliab, and I don't remember all the names. Seven older sons, and of course, David shows up as the youngest. How old is David when he gets anointed king? I'm glad none of you raise your hands, because no one knows. No one knows how old he is. We know how old he isn't. But we don't know how old he actually is. Is he an infant? No. Is he an old man? No. We know he's in his relative youth. Now, does that mean he's in his 20s? Could be, but not likely. is he in his teens? Likely, but most likely the upper end of his teens. Well, how do I know that? Well, that's with my little perspective chart. which we're going to get to, but I have to take care of one thing first. When David gets anointed, of course, the horn goes on him and the party and all that kind of stuff happens, yada, yada, yada. The Spirit leaves Saul and travels to David. Of course, Saul notices this, or all of his servants notice this drop in his composure. At this point, does Saul know who David is? Not likely. It's possible, but highly unlikely. Does Saul know who Jesse is? Probably. Most likely he would. Why? Because Jesse has 8 sons, all of which will be conscripted into Saul's army. By the way, in case you weren't aware of this, if you are a male and you were in Israel at this time, and the king says, I need to gather an army, unless you're married and you have, within the last year, and I think this one other rule, I forgot what the second rule is, there's a couple of limitations, which means all it does is postpone your enlistment. You are then immediately enlisted into the army, and of course, you serve that. And hopefully you live through it, but in a lot of cases you didn't. Is there a choice in the matter? No. Does the king have a choice? Yes. Actually, the king has the ability to exclude or separate a particular family out, say, I will not choose you. And of course, if you're Levite, that's a whole other separate issue, because most of the Israelites were not Levites, but Levites didn't serve in the army either. But every other male, and that includes David and his family, his brothers, are required to serve in the army once they reach military age. What's military age? 20 years old. That's standard Torah. You are a child until you are at 20 or older. Then you are no longer a child. You are strictly on your own. So, males, 20 years old. Conscripted army. David's not in the army yet. At this point in the story, he's not in the army yet. And by the way, the army doesn't sit there like we think of today. We ship our guys over to, you know, some army base and live there for years and years and years. No, no, no. You're called up when there is a battle to go to, and when the battle's over, you go home. That's the nature of the conscription. It's not as we envision today that they take care of your every meal you need from this point forward, you and your family and your children, which are all on welfare most likely, because the army doesn't pay a whole lot. But that's just the nature of life. It doesn't run in that fashion like we run it today. It is a temporary army, typically seasonal, along with the battles and, of course, the seasons. So, most likely Saul doesn't know David. Saul might know one of David's brothers. I doubt it. He probably does know Jesse, or at least is familiar with Jesse's family. So when Saul's advisors say, all right, you have the spirit of melancholy, you're disheartened. They say, all right, well, we know somebody. We know a guy. This Bethlehemite, he has a son. Bring him over to me. But look at what they describe him as. If I get to that verse, just flip my page wrong. Verse 18. Young, one of the servants spoke up, behold, I've seen the son of Jesse, Bethlehemite, who knows how to play, is a mighty man of valor and a man of war, who understands a matter and is a handsome man. And the Lord is with him. Wait a minute. How old is David? Teens. He just said, a man of valor, a man of war. Wait a minute. Whoa. Hold on a second here. A teenager, being a man of valor and a man of war, which is illegal. How old is David? He's got to be at least 20. You cannot go to war unless you are at the age of 20 or greater. So at this point in time, which we place David in his teens, how is that possible? Oh, hold on a minute.
I don't know the time between the anointing and the time when his servants said, we'll go get a man for you to, right? I mean, there's a passage of time there.
There's a passage of time. How much time passed? We don't know. That's what point I was getting to. So you place him at 20 at the time which he goes and sees Saul, which is consistent with the following chapter when he kills Goliath. He has to be at least 20 years old to kill Goliath because it's illegal not to, or illegal to do it otherwise. So he'll be 20, or he's at or near 20. So when he's anointed, how old is he? I place him late teens. And my little timeline there will show he actually has a 3-year possibility. He's either 17, 18, or 19. He cannot be 16 and he cannot be 20, which we'll cover that in a minute. So we don't know his exact age. But we know what age he is not. He's not 20 years old when he is anointed, and he is not under the age of 17 when he is anointed king. Still a youthful individual, which we'll get there why that's the case in a minute. So he gets anointed. And some time passes, whether it is a moment, could be. Maybe he is 19 years old and one day shy of 20. I don't know. But mostly some time has passed. And Saul notices, all right, you don't instantaneously drop into a depression and then that same day decide, I need a harpist. It takes time for people to notice that your depression has affected your mood. Thus, to need a harp player. I think that's how you call them. So we don't know the exact age of David. We know what he's close to. So Saul gives a description, a mighty man of valor, a man of war. At this point in time, David most likely has been in war or maybe a peon kind of thing, a little bottom end people that don't do a whole lot. I mean,
filling
trenches. Yeah, exactly. Digging a trench, whatever. The boring stuff. But man of valor, man of war, he has to at least gone through war of some form. Just a battle, so it doesn't take a lot. Saul says, oh, this is great, bring him on. Okay, we'll go ahead and go forward. I'm going to... let's finish this first off. Verse 22, Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my eyes. And 23, it happened that whenever the spirit of melancholy came upon from God was upon him, David would take the harp and play it, and Saul would be relieved. It's a very nice, wonderful ending. Now let's get to actually what actually matters. My little chart here. Ta-da! I have little lines on this chart. There's a green line on the right-hand side, and there's a black line on the left-hand side, and a little green line thing bottom there at the corner. This is a sequence of events that occur in David's early life, which is why I'm bringing this up to you, because I know we have a hard time believing how old David really is and the things he has already seen prior to him being anointed as a king. I had a hard time wrapping around my head, but David's seen a lot more than we give him credit for. And I was wrong, by the way, a few months ago when I said David was probably in his 10 to 11 years old. No, that's not true. he was at least late teens. I've done enough more research that corrected that previous mistake. Those who go back in the audios, you will notice that I claimed he was probably a preteen. 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 2, specifies that the Ark of the Covenant was returned to Israel from the Philistines. All right, the Ark then came back. We remember the story with the rats and the various body parts we won't discuss. And a few other components that happened with Dagon's God got knocked over. They brought the cart over the hill, and all the Philistine governors were upset and blah, blah, blah. But at that moment in time, Shiloh had already been destroyed with Eli and his sons being killed, right? Remember that part. That was how they captured the Ark. They had the Ark for 7 months in the Philistine camp. Philistines returned the Ark, and it did not return to Shiloh. Right, for those of you who recall. It stayed in Kirjath-Yearim in Abinadab's house, the man on the hill. In that verse, it specifies the Ark returns and becomes, returns to that place in Abinadab's house, and is there for 20 years. 20 years it stayed there. Exactly 20. Doesn't say 21, doesn't say 19. It's 20 years it is there. That same day, or 7 months earlier when Eli was killed, Samuel became judge of all of Israel. That same event. It's all one event. So, Samuel, chapter 7, the ark is moved to Abinadab's house, and it's there for 20 years, and Samuel becomes judge. It says 20 years go by before the ark is moved out of Abinadab's house. Those of you who recall the story of Uzzah, whatever his name was, who tries to steady the ark and he dies because he touched it, that happens when David is king, because David is the one who removes it from Abinadab's house 20 years after it was in his house. Okay? David, as king, it specifies 2 Samuel, chapter, I think it's 6, as David as king commands it to be removed out, so it comes out, and the whole fiasco there happens. 20 years go by, though. But David's moving it from Abinadab's house to where? No, not Shiloh. We classify today as the city of David. No, it says Jerusalem. Zion. The little town right outside the city. David had built his little small tent there. Of course, Solomon built this big, massive, huge thing, but we'll get to that point when he's around. So David's moving it from Abinadab's house to the city of David, or Mount Zion, that territory, that area, 20 years later. When did David, as a king, by the way, it says he's as a king when he does this, when did he move to the city of David, or what we call the city of David now? When did he live there? Well, not that we remember this, because yeah, I had to look it up too. 7 years after he takes over as king. Because David doesn't live in Jerusalem, or that whole region, for the first 7 years as a king. He lives in Hebron. God commanded him to rule from Hebron. That's where he lives. That's where he is as king. Over all of Israel? No. Hebron, he's king only of the tribe of Judah. He's for seven years and 6 months, I believe it was called. It might be 7 months. It's something like that. He's in Hebron. Then he moves, when he takes all of Israel, and Ishbosheth, I don't recall what happens off the top of his head, Saul, one of his last sons, was king of the rest of the nations. He moves 7 years later to the city of David, Jerusalem. Now, my little timeline here, I assumed the very day David moves in is the day he commands to bring the ark over. That's not true. But the problem is, if it's not, that means it just makes David that much older, meaning that he's closer to 19 versus closer to 17. It doesn't really matter. Whether he waits that day or goes within the first 3 years, he's between 17 and 19. You can choose which one you prefer. I don't really care. So 7 years prior, when David becomes king of Hebron, how old is he? Well, according to the book of Samuel, he is exactly the age of 30 years. When he becomes king, not anointed king, when he becomes king, as in he takes over the tribe of Judah as king, he's 30 years old. Okay. So let's do the math here. 20 years before he moves the ark, goes down 20 years, okay. We go back 7 now, 7 years before he moves the ark, assuming it's 7. It could have been as great as 10, but it's probably the 7. He takes over king. So how many years is that from the ark being captured by the Philistines? 13 years? So Saul and Samuel's combined reign has to be no greater than 13 years. It cannot be greater than 13 years. All right, that's because David gets anointed, becomes king, and Samuel comes, goes, he dies. All that happens with that 20-year time span. So their combined cannot be more than 13. Could it be 13? Like, could Saul have reigned for 13 years? Possible. That means Samuel reigned for probably a few days. And that's not likely. Why am I going through all this? Because your Bibles have a problem. A mathematics problem. Those of you who have noticed, the book of Acts claims Saul was king for 40 years. Huh. Let's see. 20 years how do I... Oh, actually, 20, take it back. 20 years minus 7. So I got 13 years. How do we get 40 years in 13? Any volunteers? Any ideas? How do you make 40 years fit inside of 13 years? Paradox? Yeah. Time, whatever they call it, the ribbon in time, that was that book. You don't. That's the next question. And by the way, I looked that up too. It's not recorded how old he was when he died. It is recorded how old his son is when his son takes over the throne the same day that David takes over the throne of Hebron. His son, the one that survived, Ishbosheth, I butchered his name, it don't really matter. He is 40 years old when he takes over the other remaining tribes, and David's 30. They're both recorded the same chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 6. The exact ages. Ishbosheth, whatever the guy's name is, he reigns for 2 years total, and then his reign ends. David, of course, his reigns in Hebron for 7 years, and then, of course, he takes over all of Israel later. So, how old does that make Saul when he died if Ishbosheth is 40? At minimum, 60, because Saul has a bunch of older sons than Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth was not the oldest. Jonathan was before him. Forgot all their names. I wrote it down here probably somewhere. Oh, well. Yeah, I think he has 4 sons. All but one die or are killed. So Ishbosheth is the last one that doesn't die. Saul's sons, Bethsan, died. They're older than Ishbosheth. So what does that make Saul? He's probably actually older than 60. He's probably closer to 65, 70-ish when he dies. Not a young man. How old does it make him when he was anointed king? Well, he only has a 13 combined span of time he's to share with Samuel. So he's probably 40s, late 40s, give or take. Probably early 50s, hard to say the exact age. What does all this mean? Jonathan, how old is Jonathan? Jonathan is Saul's oldest son when Jonathan dies. It's not recorded. I know this may sound really boring, but it's not to me. Jonathan older than Ishbosheth, that means Jonathan has to be greater than 40. If David is 30 and Jonathan is 40 when Jonathan dies, or at least older than 40, that means Jonathan has to be somewhere around the 30s or so when Samuel or Saul took over as king. 10 years older than David? That's conceivable. They were good friends. But there's nothing that says you cannot be friends with someone who's 10 years older than you. So Jonathan was probably in his 40s, if not 50s. It's hard to say. But Jonathan had a 5-year-old son the moment he died. Places him probably in his 30s or so, late 30s, when he had his son. So my point is, all of this stuff is all jammed together. And the reason I want to bring it all out is because how old is David when the ark is taken from Samuel and Eli? Take 30 years minus 13. 30 years minus 13. 17. 17-year-old man when Samuel takes over. Boy, man, what do you call him? He knew the Philistines. He knew the ark. He knew what happened. He was old enough, he experienced it. There's a reason why God chose him as a man of his own heart. Because he saw what happened to God's kingdom. He saw what happened to God's temple. He was alive. He remembers it. He knew who Samuel was. He knew the details. He knew all the history. He knew everything. God chose it because David knew all this stuff, and David's heart followed God after finding out all these horrible things what the high priests were doing. David is a 17-year-old man, at the youngest, when Samuel takes over as judge. And David kills Goliath while he's still under the age of 20 or near 20. they still call the youth. So, from 17 years old, and Samuel takes over, to before he reaches 20, Saul has to have been anointed king, conquered at least two armies, and established an army against the Philistines to conquer Goliath. And David gets anointed. All in a four-year time span. There's a lot of events backing up together, aren't they? That's back to back to back. We have them separated by chapters, but they're not. They're by just a few years. From the moment in which God wipes out Shiloh and Goliath falls down dead, is at maximum 4 years. That's quite impressive. I wanted to bring this out because I feel it's important. I think it's important to note what God did and how these people all knew each other. They were aware of one another. They knew how each other thought, how each other felt. They had the same life experiences. They fought side by side in all these various battles. When the Amalek had to get wiped out, there's a good chance David's brothers were there. When Saul made his mistake with the, you shall not eat anything whilst we take out the Philistines, and everybody was starving to death and couldn't do anything about it, David and his brothers were probably there. David necessarily, but at least his brothers were there. They all knew the problems with Saul. They all knew the inherent problem that Saul had a tendency to follow people in spite of what God commanded him to do. That was his inherent tendency, his Achilles heel. And I wanted to bring this out because David is not some little child. Saul is not some young man. Jonathan's not even that young. If all this happens in a short period of time, they all experience the same God. It's a funny way of wording it, but they experienced all the same events that all molded them identical, and yet they all diverged in such different directions. They all carried their lives out differently, even though they went to the same life story. They all saw what happened to the high priest. Saul was there. Saul's sons were there. Saul's father was there with the high priest. Eli died. Eli was killed. Shiloh's not that far from Bethlehem. Jesse knew it. Jesse's sons knew it. David probably knew one of the high priests. Now he's not personally, but at least met him. They all know one another. And they all resulted in a different path they took. I want to discuss this because I want to get at why God calls David a man after his own heart. And the only way we're going to find out is you read what happened to him and put into perspective what and why he did what he did. David was a bloody man. Is God a bloody man? David was a harpist. Does God like music? David saw corruption in the high priest, and God slaughtered them all. It was three people. David didn't stand for it either. In order to understand the heart of God, you have to understand the people whom he claimed were his own heart. And that's why I wanted to discuss this today. I know it's rather simple. Maybe it's not terribly important to most of us. But I find it fascinating that David and Saul and Samuel and everything, all these various events we've read nine chapters, were all back-to-back really close together. From Saul being anointed king to David being anointed king. Only 4 years. That's a very short period of time.